Support for 89.7 NPR News comes from the James at Ohio State. The best outcomes for treating cancer come from early detection. The James Cancer Diagnostic Center is designed to provide rapid evaluation and a clear diagnosis to those who suspect they have cancer. Learn more at cancer.osu.edu/diagnosticcenter.
Welcome to All Sides with Amy Jurevich. Over the past few decades, youth cheerleading has transformed from a sideline activity into a high-stakes, highly competitive sport. With thousands of gyms, national competitions, and major events, it has become one of the fastest-growing youth sports in the United States. But with that growth has come questions about regulation, costs, and the accessibility of the sport that often requires families to make major financial sacrifices. Cheer is more than pom-poms and cartwheels. It's a big competitive world worth billions of dollars. So how did cheer grow to be so popular, so competitive, and sometimes so dangerous? Joining us now is David Herbert, an investigative journalist and a contributing writer for The New York Times. He wrote a piece last year called How Cheerleading Became So Acrobatic, Dangerous, and Popular. Thank you for joining us today, David.
Thanks for having me.
So last year, you published a piece about the cheerleading industry. How did you end up writing such an in-depth piece on this topic? How did you end up talking about cheerleading?
So I didn't initially got an interest in the world of cheerleading because I was actually looking into the New York Knicks sideline dancers. And I called around a bunch of former dancers thinking that there'd be some salacious, incredible story about the Knicks. And it turned out actually the Knicks are a wonderful organization to work for and they're really great. And Patrick Ewing's quite nice. But one of the people I spoke to said, oh, if you're interested in a story about cheerleading, Google the name Jeff Webb. And Jeff Webb is the sort of modern founder of the sport. And so I Googled his name and sort of found this raft of interesting backstory and history and litigation and kind of set off from there.
Okay. So you were taken away from the Knicks and into this world of cheerleading. Your article mainly focuses on Varsity Spirit, which calls itself the global leader in cheerleading and dance. Its site lists everything from fashion to clinics to competitions. Even yearbooks are listed on its site. So to say this company is huge in cheerleading is an understatement. Can you tell me a little bit about its founder, Jeff Webb? He calls himself the father of cheerleading. There's a lot to talk about regarding him, but can we start with some background? How did he become the father of cheerleading?
Yeah, so Jeff grew up in Texas, and he was a high school cheerleader himself. Sort of cheered in college. And it was while he was in college that he met a man named Lawrence Herkimer, who is now sort of considered the, quote, grandfather of cheer, but at the time was really the proud dad of cheerleading. And he sort of in the post-war period, you know, invented the pom-pom, you know, literally invented the pom-pom, invented some like early cheer moves. And he basically took Jeff under his wing as a sort of, you know, surrogate son almost, and brought him into the business. And over the course of several years, Jeff, you know, decided, I think I could do this better, and broke away and created his own company and sort of eventually eclipsed his mentor and created Varsity Spirit and everything that we have now.
So that guy, the first guy you talked about, Herkimer, he's such the grandfather of cheerleading that even a main cheerleading move, isn't it called the Herky? Is that named for him?
Yeah, there's like a jump where you kind of jump in the air and make like an I with your body. That's known as the Herky because his last name's Herkimer. Yeah.
So the cheerleading landscape has really changed since the days of the grandfather of cheerleading and just pom-poms and herkies. Can you talk about how Jeff Webb made cheerleading into this big competitive thing with didn't he introduce some of like the moves that, you know, we associate with cheerleading now?
Yeah. You know, when Jeff came in, into the sport in the 70s, it really was not a sport. It was a sideline activity, you know, girls and boys sort of cheering on the football team or whatever. And he basically infused this very acrobatic, very almost gymnastic style athleticism to the sport. And if you watch, you know, even a movie like Bring It On with Kirsten Dunst, you know, that's the kind of cheerleading you're seeing. That's so far removed from what it was in the 70s and 60s when Jeff was initially coming on the scene. I mean, today it really is a true sport, like incredible athleticism. And it really has much more in common with, say, gymnastics than it does with your sort of colloquial vision of cheerleading.
Your piece dives into Varsity Spirit and Jeff Webb, but it also dives into some of the dangers with cheerleading. Can you talk a little bit about how these moves where, you know, people are literally tossed up into the air and caught, how dangerous are they?
So at periods in cheerleading's history, recent history, cheerleading has arguably been the most dangerous sport, even perhaps rivaling football in terms of head and neck injuries. And a lot of that is driven by the girls who are the so-called flyers. And these are the girls who are thrown in the air and they spin around like batons and then they're caught or hopefully caught by their teammates. You know, in the piece, we quote Robert Cantu, who's a doctor who's studied sports injuries. And, you know, he says that the flyer, you know, the girl that gets thrown in the air at periods has been the most dangerous position in all of women's sports, you know, any women's sport you can find. And, you know, one of the issues is that it is a newer sport and the regulations and the rules have not, you know, today, Varsity would argue they have caught up to the sport, but for many years they had not caught up and you had, you know, soaring emergency room visits, catastrophic injuries, deaths of cheerleaders, because there really wasn't the proper oversight of these moves.
Yeah, we can get more into the oversight a little bit later, but I wanted to come back to Varsity Spirit because this is a group I had not heard of until I read your story, but they are everywhere. I mean, they have really immersed themselves in all things cheerleading. And if you were involved in cheerleading, I guess you would know about this group. Or you might not. Maybe they are too high up in it. Would you say that anyone who in anywhere who is associated with cheerleading knows about Varsity Spirit?
Most people whose children are doing all-star cheerleading, and that's the sort of like, you know, travel team cheerleading, which is not at high school necessarily, but really on weekends and going on the road to tournaments, they'll have a sense of what this company is and who they are. I don't think they often understand the scale of their involvement and how many tentacles they have in this industry. You know, Jeff Webb, if you compare Jeff Webb to James Naismith, the inventor of basketball, it's as if, you know, the inventor of basketball went on to create Nike and the NBA Finals and USA Basketball and operate youth camps. I mean, they literally every corner of this industry in the youth space, they have a finger in it. It's very hard to spend money in cheerleading without some of it going back to Varsity.
Another organization you discuss in your piece is called the United States All-Star Federation. Can you tell us a bit about them and where they fit into the modern cheer landscape? What kind of group are they?
Yeah. So, you know, initially when cheerleading was growing, there really was no regulatory framework in place because it was a very new sport. And some of the cheer coaches came together and in the early 2000s tried to set up their own rules organization, as you might expect in a sport. And Varsity said, well, actually, wait a minute, we'll start our own organization because we can finance it and we have the right people and the right expertise. And so Varsity created the USASF, the US All-Star Federation, with an eye towards sort of, you know, overseeing the sport, you know, creating a rules system. And that organization and its other regulatory organizations that Varsity has created are sort of at the center of extensive litigation that has cropped up in the last 4 or 5 years, which we can get into.
Yeah. Yeah. The United States All-Star Federation was supposed to act as like a regulatory body, right? But in this aspect, because it was created by Varsity, it was kind of a conflict of interest. That's what you found?
Well, that's certainly what the plaintiffs in a number of class action suits would allege, right? They would say that while these organizations were perhaps created with the best intentions, they also came into direct conflict with Varsity's profit motive, right? Which, you know, led to a raft of abuses in the sport that this litigation would argue. And there's been, I think all of the, or most of the suits are settled now, but to the tune of tens and tens of millions of dollars. So you can debate who's at fault here, but this has been a lot of money at stake in this litigation because a lot of people have been hurt, both economically in terms of business competitors of Varsity, and then also kids who have been sexually abused in the sport.
This is All Sides on 89.7 NPR News. We're talking about cheerleading with David Herber, a contributing writer for The New York Times. He wrote an investigative piece called How Cheerleading Became So Aerobatic, Dangerous, and Popular. So you talked about the litigation. So Varsity and Jeff Webb himself was involved in a lot of different litigation, from being called a monopoly. They were involved in antitrust lawsuits. And then you also mentioned the sexual abuse allegations. There was also the financial piece. I mean, it's just, did you figure out how many lawsuits were out there?
So there were a number of major class action lawsuits representing, you know, potentially thousands of plaintiffs. There's also been, I mean, when I was reporting the piece, every time I would turn around, there'd be a new sexual abuse lawsuit from some gym where there was a predator gym owner. You know, I think to be fair to Varsity, they would say, look, you know, yes, we're the dominant company in this space. We're the ones with the big dollar signs around us, and plaintiffs see us as a great place to try to collect a check and lay a lot of blame at our feet. And while there may be problems in the sport, they can't all be blamed on Varsity. I think the other side, that some of their critics would say, that the reason that a lot of blame can be blamed, can be put at Varsity's feet, is that they've actually sought to become, you know, arguably a monopoly in the space, that they have controlled most of the regulatory bodies. And so there really is no one else to blame for the problems in the sport except Varsity.
Yeah. And with some of the sexual abuse allegations that you wrote about in your piece, it was maybe a gym owner or a coach and the people involved just wanting someone to be held accountable for keeping them in their position or hiring them in general. So was Varsity seen as, because Varsity owned or operated most of the big gyms, right? If you wanted to excel in cheerleading, you went to a Varsity gym. Is that right?
Well, actually, no. So Varsity doesn't control the gyms. And so that's been their defense all along, is that any abuse that happens at gyms has nothing to do with Varsity. It's bad actors in those spaces. What the litigation alleges is that the owners of these large gyms, particularly these gyms that are chains, they're driving so much cash to Varsity in the form of tournament fees, apparel purchases, camp subscriptions, that when the regulatory bodies uncover abuse or alleged abuse at these gyms, they're not motivated to investigate fully because that could be tarnishing one of Varsity's big customers. That's been the thrust of the litigation. Varsity, of course, denies this and says, and they have, in fact, you know, set up sexual abuse hotlines and all the rest. But there's definitely the appearance, the litigation would argue, the appearance that there's a bit of self-dealing, I guess you would say, with regards to the oversight of the gyms.
Okay. I guess I misunderstood that they didn't actually own the gyms. But because, I mean, you mentioned like gyms getting $200,000 in bonuses because they send people to competitions and camps and that kind of thing. So there's a lot of money involved, but not maybe ownership. Is that right?
There's a lot of money involved, and that's correct. And I think that one of the things that parents find so frustrating, cheer parents find frustrating about this sport, is in fact, it's pretty confusing to piece this all together. I mean, it took me a year to put this story together, you know, and still I barely scratched the surface of what was going on. There's a lot of names of companies. It's a lot of names of regulatory bodies. If you just want your 10-year-old daughter to be on a cheer team, are you really going to spend 3 months searching through litigation and the internet to figure out who gets paid what? And in fact, one of the things that, you know, the litigation surfaced was that, you know, parents really had no idea just how much of the money they were paying gym owners that they were paying to Varsity was flowing back to their local gyms in the form of essentially kickbacks, the litigation would argue, kickbacks to gym owners. And so, you know, the sport is incredibly expensive, and the litigation argues that it's artificially expensive because of Varsity's monopoly, because of a lot of these rebates that gym owners get. And that's, again, the thrust of the parents' class action against Varsity.
Yeah, and some of the antitrust cases, there was more than one related to whether Varsity had a monopoly over cheerleading. Didn't they? They were settled. Is that what you found, like out of court? Or
yeah, they've been largely settled out of court in the last few years. And you know, obviously, Varsity assumed no liability in those cases. But the kind of the discovery that those lawsuits uncovered was pretty interesting, and especially some of the emails, which we include in the story, where the company is pretty open about the fact that, you know, they need to be hiding from parents just how much money is flowing into Varsity's coffers. For example, when you go to one of the cheerleading tournaments at Disney World, you know, you buy a park hopper pass from Varsity for a certain amount of money. I think it was like $400. But what they don't tell you is that they've gotten that pass from Disney for about, you know, $100, and they're pocketing a huge profit. And there's even emails where they say, you know, we really need to make sure parents don't understand just how much money we're making in all of this. And I think, you know, parents, after they read the story, some of them reached out to me and were sort of shocked by just how much they'd sort of been hoodwinked. They felt they'd been hoodwinked by the company.
One figure you quoted is that it's not abnormal for a parent to spend upwards of $10,000 on an all-star cheer program. Where does that number come from?
Yeah, and honestly, that was kind of low. I later heard that there might be more like $15,000 or $20,000. Some of that is, you know, uniforms. You know, some of these uniforms are custom made with crystals on them that you buy from Varsity. There's, you know, traveling to tournaments. There's the hotels. The hotels, a lot of the litigation alleged, were artificially inflated in terms of price so that the hotels could give kickbacks to Varsity. Again, kickback is a loaded term, but that's the term used in the litigation. There's fees for attending these massive tournaments. There's obviously gym fees. So there's just an endless kind of number of things that you can spend money on. And then the girls, that it's mostly girls who are on these teams, they want to go to the big tournaments, and the big tournaments are run by Varsity. They're incredibly well put together. I mean, you feel like you're going to, like, honestly, like a college level or even professional level sporting event. Disney World built its own cheer facility for Varsity to host these events. It's incredible. There's huge pageantry. It's amazing. I went to a couple of these tournaments. They're awesome. Varsity does a great job in that respect. And how do you say no to your daughter who wants to do this, and all of her friends are on this team? You know, one of the things that we found out in the course of the story was I got onto a Facebook group for cheer moms. And aside from people asking questions about how to do their girls' hair and makeup, the big question was, how can I make more money to pay for cheerleading? And it was kind of shocking and saddening, heartbreaking to see that one of the big ways that moms are making money is they're selling blood. They're selling blood plasma in order to raise the money for cheerleading. And so they're literally sort of, their blood, sweat, and tears are going into the sport.
Wow.
That
is a lot. Yeah. We are going to continue our conversation with David Herbert. Coming up, we're going to talk more about whether cheerleading is actually a sport or an activity, or what should we call it? We'll talk more with David Herbert in just a moment, a contributing writer for The New York Times. That's when All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
Rare to find a podcast that can actually change your life. But when the show's called Life Kit, that's kind of the whole point. I'm Mariel Segarra. 3 times a week on the Life Kit podcast, we guide you through a topic we could all use help with, from personal development to healthy living to managing your dinero, with takeaways so you can start living what you learn right away. Escucha el Life Kit podcast from NPR.
You're listening to All Sides. I'm your host, Amy Jurevich. At the center of the cheerleading world is Varsity Spirit, the company that oversees a vast majority of competitions, camps, and uniforms. Its dominance in the market is tricky, as it is the reason for cheerleading's growth and success, as well as creating a professional system around the sport. However, the company has also drawn criticism, with concerns over being a monopoly, pricing, and the influence over the direction of the sport and the control it has over the cheerleaders involved. Still with us is David Herbert, an investigative reporter and contributing writer for The New York Times, who wrote an investigative piece on youth cheerleading in America. The piece is called How Cheerleading Became So Acrobatic, Dangerous, and Popular. David, thanks again for joining us today.
Sure.
So One thing that Varsity Spirit worked at was to they prevented a blanket countrywide recognition of cheerleading as being a sport. The NCAA, for example, does not recognize it as a sport at the college level. And this led to a lack of cohesive regulation around cheerleading. Why is it not an NCAA sport?
Yeah, I mean, so Varsity from the very beginning has been pretty adamant that cheer not be considered a sport. You know, they would argue that making it a sport would introduce a bunch of unnecessary, you know, regulations and limits on when people could cheer and what seasons. And they have a lot of good reasons for opposing sports status. But on the opposing side argues, look, if you're not a sport, you don't have regulations in terms of how much you practice. You don't have as much access to medical staff. You don't have access to the right training facilities. And, you know, Varsity internal documents show, and these are internal documents that came out as part of litigation, that really it was a business decision to push for the sport, well, for cheerleading not to be considered a sport. I think the quote in one of the SEC filings, which was public, was that there'd be a material adverse effect on their business if cheerleading became a sport.
But yeah, I guess it would be at the NCAA, there would be regulations on what season it's in, you know, spring, summer, fall, winter, all that. But then also there would be regulations on whether if a move was too dangerous and people kept getting hurt, maybe the NCAA would ban that move or something like that. Is that were they worried about that type of regulation?
It was more about my understanding is more about the time and seasons and time periods when people could be doing cheerleading. You know, if you're playing football, your coach can't make you practice 40 hours a week, 52 weeks a year. Mm-hmm. When you're in the off season, there's caps on how often you can practice. But that's not true with cheerleading. And one of the reasons that people say that Varsity didn't want this cap is that they wanted high school cheerleaders, for example, to be able to travel to different tournaments all over the country and pay Varsity for these tournaments. But one of the adverse effects is that, you know, you have people just training too much, overtraining, you know, lack of oversight, lack of medical treatment, medical staff basically assigned to them at these schools at the high school and college level.
You wrote that some individual states have decided to make cheerleading a sport. So I looked it up, and the Ohio High School Athletic Association, they list Spirit, they call it Sideline Spirit, not cheerleading, is listed on their website under the sports list. And it also lists competitive cheerleading as a sponsored event. Do you know what any of that means?
It's funny you should say that. There's been this sort of like wordplay done for years because there really, you know, there are two different activities/sports going on here. There's sideline cheerleading, which is jumping up and down saying, let's go Ohio State. And then there's doing crazy backflips and being thrown in the air as a flyer, which is more, you know, all-star cheer and this more competitive form of cheerleading. And, you know, perhaps some people would say sideline cheer shouldn't be considered a sport because there's less risk of injury and all this stuff, but that competitive cheer should be. I think what's going on there is probably some of this word parsing to try to delineate between these different forms of cheerleading. This world is very complicated. Even after a year of being in it, I was encountering new words and ideas that I hadn't previously encountered. And I can't imagine how confusing it is to parents, to be honest.
So if you are a competitive cheerleader and you go to a gym and you go to varsity competitions on the weekends and travel to Disney World, you're probably not doing that for your school, for your school district. You're probably doing that. That's like a side activity. Is that what that means?
Correct. In the same way that there is sort of travel team baseball and then high school baseball, you know, you might be on your high school team and also be on a club team that costs extra money and you're traveling with a bunch of other people that don't go to your high school to different tournaments. That's a lot of girls are on, you know, their high school cheer team maybe, but then also at a gym on one of these competitive travel all-star cheer teams going to varsity events.
This is All Sides on 89.7 NPR News. We're talking about cheerleading with David Herbert, a contributing writer for The New York Times. Now, for your piece, it's a lengthy piece, and I encourage all of our listeners to read it because we're actually only scratching the surface here. You talked to Jeff Webb himself. You had a sit-down interview with him, right?
A couple, yeah.
A couple. What was that like?
It was great. I mean, he met me at his PR firm's, public relations firm's office in Manhattan. He had his lawyer with him. So it didn't exactly engender the most intimate interview format that I've ever had, but he's incredibly charming. He is a very good storyteller and narrativizer of his own life story. I really like him personally. I don't know what he thinks of me, but I thought he was quite charming. But yeah, he's very proud of what he built. You know, he has said, I think in a video or a documentary stuck in my head, he said, you know, only in America would this be possible. And it's true. You know, you just couldn't imagine cheerleading becoming a multi-billion dollar sport in Canada or France. And it is a very American sport. It's a very American business success story. And a lot of the kind of dark sides of the business, and many people would argue, are also an American story. He says the right things about the sexual abuse stuff and the injuries, and no one has ever accused him really of any wrongdoing personally. But he's very, I wouldn't say he's defensive, but he has a belief that they've really tried to do the right thing through all of this.
What did he have to say whenever you talked to him about all of these lawsuits? Because my understanding is he's not with the company anymore, right?
He's not with the company anymore, and he didn't really want to talk about why that is. But, you know, some of our reporting uncovered that he had had friction with the private equity firms that had come in and bought the business. I mean, that's a whole other part of the story. This
I know, we didn't even get into the private equity firms. Yeah. There's billions of dollars here. Yeah.
The business is really now owned by private equity investors who are you know, looking at it as a business, because it is a business. And Cheer has become incredibly profitable for these private equity firms. But he was pushed out of the company. He wouldn't use those terms, but some of our research and reporting found that he was pushed out of the company, a few years back. But he remains involved in the sport because he's pushing to make cheerleading an Olympic sport.
Doesn't it need to be a sport then, or be regulated to be in the Olympics?
Well, now, yes, you fit on one of the chief ironies of the anti-sport push of cheerleading. Is on the one hand, varsity has said that it's not a sport at the high school and college level, and yet also maybe cheer is an Olympic sport. So there has been a lot of sort of wordplay involved in that.
When you were doing reporting for this, did you talk with anyone who actively works at varsity right now related to the sexual abuse lawsuits or the monopoly lawsuits? Did varsity talk to you?
Varsity spoke to us. And then we had many sources, current and former sources at the company, who were able to speak to it. Yeah.
Yeah.
There's a huge universe of people to talk to in this sport, but by the same token, I've never encountered more press shy, sort of paranoid sources in a piece like this one. I had a father whose, you know, daughter had issues at her gym and had been bullied by the coach and the gym owner. And I said, oh, like we should talk more. And he truly believed that, quote, goons from the gym would come to his house and threaten him if he was quoted in the article. I've never encountered that before. I mean, maybe writing about terrorism, but not about cheerleading.
Right. Well, what did varsity have to say for themselves? Obviously they defended themselves. Some of these lawsuits they did settle out of court, but I'm guessing, you know, that from your perspective of interviewing them, I can't remember exactly what it said in the article, but they were just trying to do what's best for the company.
Yeah, I mean, I think their position would be sort of multifold. I mean, one thing that they would say, and in fact, Jeff said in our conversations, was that, you know, these are, you know, law firms have glommed onto these cheer parents, see the dollar signs in varsity, see that it's worth billions of dollars, and are trying to get attorney's fees and are throwing together any sort of lawsuit they can to wring cash from varsity. I think they would also say that there are problems in the sport, but people are wrongly pointing the finger at varsity when in fact varsity has taken many proactive steps to deal with the injury issues, with the sexual abuse issues. By the way, with the injury issues, they've had some success, they would argue, reducing some of the head injuries. And, you know, I think they would also say, look, like, this is still a sport that's evolving and it's not baseball. It hasn't been around for 150 years. This is a pretty new sport and they're still figuring it out. I think that's what they would say. And that is what they said to me.
Hmm. Well, regarding your piece, did you get a lot of reaction to it? I saw the Cheer Mom blog had some reaction to your piece. And they posted like a letter from Jeff Webb that he wrote basically to cheerleading parents after your piece was published. What has reaction been like? Do you feel like now you could write a whole nother piece because of the reaction?
we got a lot of feedback, both sort of comments on the website, but also just private communications to me, you know, emails to me, just people from all over the country, all sort of walks of life. And what was sort of surprising to me was that the theme across a couple dozen of these emails was the same. It was, you know, I always knew something was going on, and I sort of had a sort of vague glimmers of a sense that there was this larger force behind cheerleading, and the sort of put it all together, like the mosaic has suddenly been revealed to me. And there were people at the high school level and college level, people with really sad stories, people that didn't even, some people that created burner email accounts to email me because I think they were afraid of, you know, I was going to use their name. I never would, but use their name in another article. Yeah. And it was heartening to sort of hear other people in the sport kind of share their experiences after the piece.
You spent a year looking into this. You never imagined probably spending a year in your life looking into cheerleading. What would you like to see happen? Would you like it to be an NCAA sanctioned sport? Do you hope it gets into the Olympics? I mean, what do you think is going to happen here?
I think it'd be awesome if it was an Olympic sport. I think it's an incredible sport. And I think that just the thing that I learned coming out of the article was this is more athletic than a lot of sports are, like, you know, sanctioned, you know, regulated sports are. And I just think that these boys and girls, especially girls, women, should be getting the sort of recognition they deserve. And the treatment they deserve in terms of not just not being sexually abused, but getting the medical treatment they deserve and the sort of kudos and the varsity letters and everything that comes with being this talented and athletic. And in a funny way, I don't think varsity would disagree with that sentiment. It's just how do you get there while still not, you know, infringing on varsity's profit motive? And I think that's what a lot of the litigation is about. It's like, can you have a for-profit a sport that's essentially run by a for-profit company, and how do you manage these two competing, sometimes competing interests? And the litigation sort of bore that out over years and thousands of pages of documents. Is how do you do that? It's hard.
Yeah, yeah. And emphasis on the for-profit. I would invite our listeners to read the piece so you can understand the different private equity firms and the billions of dollars involved too. But we're going to have to leave it there. We've been talking with David Herbert, an investigative reporter and contributing writer for the New York Times. He wrote an investigative piece called How Cheerleading Became So Acrobatic, Dangerous, and Popular. David, thanks for joining us on All Sides today.
Sure. Thank you.
And coming up, we're going to talk about what cheerleading looks like here in Ohio. That's when All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
Rare to find a podcast that can actually change your life. But when the show's called Life Kit, that's kind of the whole point. I'm Mariel Segarra. 3 times a week on the Life Kit podcast, we guide you through a topic we could all use help with, from personal development to healthy living to managing your dinero, with takeaways so you can start living what you learn right away. Escucha el Life Kit podcast from NPR.
You're listening to All Sides. I'm your host, Amy Jurevich. Over the past few years, cheerleading has grown bigger and bigger. it's no longer just pom-poms and cartwheels on the football sidelines. There are now cheerleading-focused gyms, competitions, and lots of fancy athletic moves. From long practices and high-pressure competitions to friendships and confidence gained through the sport, the experiences of young cheerleaders reveal both rewards and challenges in this demanding activity. What is it like to be a cheerleader today, and how has it changed in the past few years? Joining us now is Erica Gullick, owner of the Cheer Institute, a cheerleading gym based here in Columbus. Thank you for joining us, Erica.
Thank you so much for having me.
So you are a true cheerleader. I read you've been cheering since you were 3 years old, and you even cheered for 4 years at Ohio State University. Tell me, what do you love most about cheerleading?
You know, I think, just being out in front of a crowd, performing. And I think one thing that I gained the most from cheerleading is my relationships. I, had great mentors growing up that taught me all the skills that I know. And then now I'm on the other side of that, and I'm able to be a mentor. And I've been friends and become family with all of the different athletes that I've touched and the people that have trained me. And so I think that that's what people don't see is the relationships, the sisters and the brothers that you get from just being on a team, depending on each other, traveling with each other. I think that that's what I love the most is like the family that I've gained through the sport of cheerleading.
Yeah. And can you tell me about owning a cheerleading gym? How did that come about? What made you decide, you know what I'm going to do? I'm going to teach others to cheer.
You know what? I always tell people I've always had the spirit of teaching. I was always the type that I would learn the information and then I would go and reciprocate it. I really thought that I was going to just be coaching, like, on the collegiate side when I was, getting out of cheer. I was like, you know what? I want to go in advance and coach at the highest level. I actually had the opportunity to be one of the candidates for Ohio State. And but it wasn't my time for that. That wasn't the position. When I didn't get that position, I thought, well, what could I be doing to get these athletes to the next level or to get them to, something that they wanted to do in terms of advancing in cheer? And so it became training. And so what I wanted to do is I wanted to find a space. I was always, one of two athletes of color in the programs I was at. And so athletes that maybe couldn't afford, to go to a gym. There wasn't really a lot of spaces here in Columbus. And so I decided that I wanted to be on the other side of training. You know, it's cool if I'm already there and I'm just looking for the athletes that already have it. But I wanted to be on the other side to say, you know what, if you want to get there, let's start with some great training. Let's give you some good resources. Let's show you other cheerleaders that look like you. Let's provide networking opportunities and ways for you to get out there and see what the world of cheerleading can be. And so I decided to open up my own gym. I opened up in 2015, actually was at a smaller gym just doing classes, and it started to grow. And then we stepped out on faith, my husband and I, and we opened the Cheer Institute. This is our 10th season. We have 12 teams. We even have a cheer abilities team with athletes with exceptional needs. They get to go out there and get on stage. It's been awesome. And so, I just decided that I wanted to do the training and to get these different athletes around my city the exposure that they needed and the training that they needed.
Yeah, your gym does a lot. And I was looking at the website, lots of different competition levels. Can you tell me about the transition of cheerleading as a sport from just being pom-poms on the sidelines of a football game to actually going to a gym several days a week and being on a team? Tell me about that transition of the sport.
Yeah, absolutely. So, obviously, when I was cheering, I learned my basics in traditional Little League, and that was the pom-poms cheering for games. And so what it has evolved to now is adding the competitive piece. And so it's always kind of been around, but I don't think that it's been as big. Cheerleaders have gone, and we still love to cheer for other teams. But I think the competitive side allowed us to show off our own skills, showcase our skills. A lot of times when I call it game day, when you're cheering for an athletic team, there are a lot of things that you can't do and you cannot showcase. You're not able to because you don't have the correct surface or what have you. And so when you transition to that competitive side, you are really able to show off what exactly it is that you know. So it went from, you know, cheering in Little League, you know, in 2001 to 2003, I transitioned into the All-Star world, where now we are training, you know, 2 to 3 nights per week, you know, it could be anywhere from 6 to 8 hours that you're training. You're traveling to compete against other individuals on these large stages, to where now, you know, I'm not for sure if you know that there's pro teams in cheerleading. Mm-hmm. There's talks about adding it to the Olympics. And with that comes the traditional training that any other athlete in the world needs to do. My husband actually visited a game, hadn't been there in a while, and he goes, man, I think the cheerleaders work a little bit harder than the football players. And so people don't understand, you know, we're out here. We are visiting people at their tailgates. You know, we are doing different performances. We're cheering for the game. And then we go back to our practices and practice a little bit more to get ready for our competitions. Tumbling was something that has been added to the sport of cheer. You know, mm-hmm. It's on our scorecard when we're getting judged. It used to be where you didn't maybe have to have tumbling, you didn't have to have stunting, but now it has become a true performance. You know, cheerleaders are very athletic. We have to be able to hold our own body weight. We have to hold the body weight of others. We have to have trust when we're getting thrown in the air, that the trust that the bases are going to be catching us. And so you definitely have to be a little bit more athletic than you had to be, you know, back when I was starting cheerleading. And so we are. These kids are training. Our program starts at 3 years old. And so it's not as strenuous. However, you start to teach them, you know, that work ethic. You're teaching them the love for the sport. You're teaching them the terminology at a young age. So that way, as they grow through it, they become confident cheerleaders. And, I'm hoping that, you know, if my daughter or son stays loving the sport, that I could, you know, cheer them on in the Olympics one day.
The idea of being a sideline cheerleader at a sport, do most of the people who go to your gym, do they do that during football season, but then they're in your gym the rest of the time? Do they do both, I guess, is what I'm asking?
So a lot of times they do both. A lot of our and I promote both, because when you are cheering, it's oftentimes, especially if you're at a program, if you're at a college, you are still going to be cheering for the sport. And then that college also allows you to go on and compete on your own. So it is important to have the best of both worlds. And so, but they are doing that simultaneously. So our cheerleaders are, you know, making sure that they're syncing their school schedules with their gym schedule. And so we have to make sure that we're flexible when we set practices. But an average cheerleader who is cheering right now during football season and All-Star, they may be training 5 nights a week. They may get a couple of nights a week. I have a niece who she cheers at Columbus City Schools, and she is absolutely training every day of the week, probably except Saturday. Because she has her school cheer as well as All-Star cheer. And so, you know, she has a commitment to go and train them and do the games as well as coming with us. So they are getting the double training. A lot of times, you know, they have a lot of stamina. And so their body is trained to handle, you know, the strenuous training and being able to go out there at games. I even have a son. I mean, he is a football player, and he literally will play a game and then leave there, you know, rest for an hour, and then come on to train on his team at cheer. And so and he loves the performance, and so it becomes a part of their lifestyle. But they're doing it at the same time. Mm-hmm. And then once football season is over, then they continue on throughout the rest of the year. Our program, when you are an All-Star cheerleader, which means that you are training, traveling, and competing, mm-hmm. you're basically year-round. You know, you have your summer season where it's training, and then you go into your competition season. And our competition season lasts from November to around like May. So yeah. We have athletes, and we try to incorporate other things. Obviously, these are young individuals. And so what was important to me is to make sure that we are not just tapping into the kids coming in and doing the physical part, but what does their mental look like? Are they keeping up with, you know, their academics? And so we're promoting a lot more than just coming in and training. They've got to make sure that they have community service and they're, you know, representing themselves. And so I think that is one thing that's important to have when you do have a competitive mm-hmm. cheerleader.
This is All Sides on 89.7 NPR News. We're talking about youth cheerleading with Erica Gullick, owner of the Cheer Institute. It's a cheerleading gym based right here in Columbus. I was surprised to learn from talking with our previous guest that cheerleading is not considered a sport for high school or college. If the NCAA or state regulations allowed that, like, what do you think of the fact that it's not actually a sanctioned NCAA sport?
Well, you know, I think it's crazy. I mean, we are, when you think about what we are doing, we have to, you know, exercise our bodies. We have to come in and practice. We have to go out and perform. And so when you think about, well, what does a football player have to do? What is a basketball player? And what is the difference? You really can't come up with anything that's different between that athlete. So when people come to my gym, I call our students that are coming in athletes, because that's what they're doing. Mm-hmm. And they're not just coming in, they're training. So I was fortunate to be a part of two collegiate programs where the university recognized us to a certain extent. We weren't fully funded in terms of full academic or athletic scholarships. However, we were backed by Ohio State, and so we were able to travel for free. We got priority scheduling. There were different perks for representing the university, and I was on the co-ed squad. However, there was an all-girls squad that was not supported by the university, and it became a club, and so they had to pay to be able to, you know, fulfill their dreams of being a college cheerleader. And then, you know, with high school, you know, the kids out there, and they want them cheering for the teams. But a lot of times, you know, they are having to raise money and do things on their own to be able to do it. They're provided a space, but they're not acknowledged as an actual sport. And I think that is conversations. And I think people who are higher up need to come out and visit and actually see what are these individuals doing. Because I think seeing is believing. A lot of times people don't understand what All-Star Cheerleader is about until you happen to come up on it on the television, or you happen to go to a showcase or a competition. And then you really see exactly what it takes and what these kids are doing. And you will know by seeing a routine or seeing their performance that constitutes, like, they have to be training a lot in order to be able to do that. So I think it's just, you know, educating, you know, like, taking the time to educate yourself on what exactly are they doing, and what is it that other sports are doing that our cheerleaders aren't doing, which is not anything different, that constitutes them being recognized and not cheerleaders.
Yeah, earlier in the conversation, we talked with a reporter who wrote an in-depth investigative piece about the company Varsity Spirit and its founder, Jim Webb. And a part of that piece said that Varsity kind of owned the competition cheerleading world, and they used to make it so that it wouldn't be a sanctioned sport. That way they could have competitions all year round, or wouldn't be as many rules on, like, how long you're allowed to practice and stuff like that. Do you think that something like that, where keeping it out from being a sanctioned sport, allowed for more competitions? I mean, it would be helpful for your gym, I guess, to have more competitions.
Yeah, I think it creates a tunnel where, you know, you feel like that this is the only way to go. However, I think that what has evolved in even the All-Star world is that there's more independent companies that are providing opportunities to where individuals or gyms don't feel like that is the only place that they can compete. It's kind of like one of those things where it's the grandfather of cheerleading. And so, you know, back in the day, Varsity was all anybody knew. You know, it was, you need to go down this track in order to be the best. This is all you have. And so you have things like Summit, that's the end all be all, the cheerleading world. And it is, you know, people that are going there, those are amazing teams at gyms that have been in business for over 30 years, right? But there are also other competitions like the All-Star World and the Open Championship that are also providing, that has been providing that same end of year, that same competitiveness at the end of the season. And so, you know, we are one of those tracks that we've, stepped out of the box of what is the norm. And so we have been competing Open Championships, and we compete against what we call D1 and D2 gyms, which is just how many individuals you have in your group. It's not a traditional, you know, D1, D2 like you would think about collegiately. It is just, do you have a lot of athletes, you know, 125 or more, or are you a smaller gym? But the great thing about, for me, for All-Star World is that everybody is in the same pot. So it does not matter where you come from. It is literally putting your best foot forward and creating the best routine. And I can say, I'm proud to say, mm-hmm. our youth won last year, won All-Star Worlds in the Elite mm-hmm. One division, and it was tough. You know, we're going against 100 teams, you know, have to compete 2 days and keep that stamina up and hit two solid routines. And so, you know, I think that because other companies now are expanding the horizon for us, you know, it allows for us to have a greater opportunity. So, you know, at one point that could have been keeping, you know, the sport from being acknowledged on the, you know, side for school cheer. But I also think that, you know, like I said, you know, schools around the area, I think safety was a big matter. You know, we are doing a lot of things that could be risky, but it's no different than a football player, you know, running down the field and maybe mm-hmm. tearing an ACL, you know, that it could happen in any sport. But I think that that was a big thing that maybe caused schools to say, I don't know if we want to recognize this and say we support it because, you know, the dangers of it. But I think now there's a lot of safety measures. We go through a lot of trainings. We are progressing our athletes correctly, even, you know, through the USASF, who sanctions a lot of gyms. You know, there's a lot of trainings that we need to go through. And so I think it's safer as well. So I'm hoping that, you know, the people expand their minds and they do become a recognized sport.
All right. Well, I want to thank you so much for your time. Thank you for telling us about cheerleading, youth cheerleading, and your gym. We've been talking with Erica Gullick, owner of the Cheer Institute, which is a cheerleading gym based here in Columbus. Erica, thanks so much for your time today.
Thank you so much.
And you've been listening to All Sides on 89.7 NPR News. I'm Amy Jurevich.